last time we started and made some serious headway into in Kol Dodu Deofik. So this is again Rav Soloveitchik's reflections on the Holocaust. And what we saw last time essentially is that the Rav starts with a fairly engaging opening introduction. He starts with a classic question of theodicy, Tzadik Verlarlo, how do we approach that? And the Rav basically says we can ask this question in two phases. We can ask ourselves the why question, we can ask ourselves the what question. He says most of what we do is ask the why question. Why can be helpful, there can be benefits psychologically, but ultimately, philosophically, and over the long term, you end up spinning in the same place. You don't get anywhere. And so instead, what Halakha recommends is shifting from the why to the what and asking ourselves not why God brought this upon me, but rather how can I grow through this experience? In what ways can I use this? What silver lining can there be in order to somehow elevate my character and to grow through and from this experience despite the horror of it? And the Rav says Halakha accepts and grants the horrific nature of evil. Evil is real. We don't deny it. We don't philosophize it away into thin air. Just the opposite. We accept it. It exists. The question is, what can we do with it to somehow elevate ourselves? The Rav suggests this is the problem and the challenge of Eov, and that's really what the book hinges on and really turns on that problem. And essentially, the Rav's thesis is that Eov, at the beginning, in the conversations with his friends, is obsessed with the why question, and he doesn't come to the right question until the very end of the book. And for Eov, the breakthrough that allows sort of for the resolution of the book is to focus on the what, and the transition for him, in his case, the what is to transition from a sense of outward support of the community and giving to important causes without an inward identification with the suffering of his people toward a true empathic ability to really connect on a very profound level with the Jewish people, with their suffering. And it's through his own personal experience he's able to draw upon that in order to truly identify with his people. And so that's really the story of what Eov is all about. The Rav then segues into the observation, the point that this response is not just one that should be forthcoming, but it should be something that's forthcoming immediately, as quickly as possible. One should really try to respond in the moment. And the Rav says that's exactly the difference between Shaul on the one hand and David HaMelech on the other. That King Saul, when he's confronted by the prophet after his sins, his immediate reaction is rationalization, i.e., he's like all the rest of us. Right, that's just human nature, is our knee-jerk reaction. So often they say, well, but there was this extenuating circumstance, and what about that? And I have a difficult life, and the people were rocking me, and I'm so overwhelmed by the responsibilities of monarchy and so on. And God says, you know what? Your immediate response was, it's not my fault. If you can't immediately own up to your responsibility, so then you lose the kingship. David HaMelech sins in a horrific way. Right? He essentially is together with a married woman, sends her husband to the front lines so that he'd be killed on the battlefield so that he can be with her, that, right? Doesn't get much worse than that. And yet, when his response to the prophet immediately is chatati, immediately is a tremendous sense of genuine remorse and a new attitude and a real sense of tshuva immediately. And so that ensures it doesn't wipe away his sin, right? He's, perhaps for that reason among others, does not build Beit HaMikdash. It's not to say that David HaMelech, therefore, bears no responsibility, but it doesn't come to the point of stripping away his right to the kingdom. And so the Rav argues that seizing that moment, that momentary response, makes all the difference in the world from the Jewish perspective. Says the same thing is true in the halachic discipline as well, as we noted, right? When it comes to Shabbat, right? A moment before sunset, it's a mitzvah to light the candles. A moment after, right? It's a capital crime, right? It's a grave sin. So in the blink of an eye, in just a split second, just a moment, welcome, how are you? Right? In just that moment, you can lose everything, and that's it. Right? So that's essentially the thesis of the Rav. And he takes this idea of not only being responsive to suffering, but responding in the moment to suffering. He takes that to a contemporary application as well. And he talks, and now I'm on page 62. We saw this, but just... No, we don't even have to say 62. 62 concludes the Job story and then says, missing the moment. This is where he makes his point about David versus Shaul, right? He also applies this halachic notion about the missing the moment to Shir HaShirim as well. That you have this romantic, right, relationship between, right, between the lover and the beloved, and it's the knock on the door, and then for whatever reason, in a fit of near insanity, she decides not to get up. She decides not to throw on her robe and open the door, and by the time she finally changes her mind and decides to come, he's already gone, and that's what pushes, that's the drama that animates the book of the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. It's that she doesn't respond in that moment. So she misses that opportunity. Now the Rav comes to the point that we were just starting to address, and this starts on pages 72, 73. They're not, it's come out on the top, but it's, yeah, it's, is that right? 1 second. I added, changed the copies, there's everything. Sorry, it's 68, 69. You have everything this week. It's all here, all together well. And the Rav now says that this notion of missing the knocks, everyone has, it says six knocks on the bottom left of the page. And the Rav says, this notion of missing the knocks is not just some philosophical principle, it's not just about the halachic discipline, it's not just about the shir, about Shir HaShirim. Right. Yep, you got it. Right. He says this is true of us as well. And this is where the Rav moves from a beautiful, moving and brilliant presentation to one that is that's truly sublime. I mean, there's just, you can hear him delivering the lecture, you can hear the rhetoric, you can hear the oratory. It's just unbelievable. And he had the refrain of, it's the voice of my beloved that knocks. That's why he intentionally concluded the previous section with Shir HaShirim, not only because it's a beautiful illustration of the importance of responding in the moment, but more than that, because it's, right, it's, there's an oratorical device here that the Rav wants to use, right? So just like Martin Luther King comes to the point about, right, I have a dream, and then, right, he sets that up and then uses it. So the Rav, obviously it's not nearly as acclaimed a speech of that order, but you can see how some of the greatest oratory and some great orators, the Rav was certainly a first-class orator in addition to a scholar and a philosopher, they intentionally structure their presentations in such a way that it allows them to use those motifs not only to illustrate the ideas, but really as rhetorical devices that can be truly soaring and really move an audience. And that's exactly what the Rav does. So he comes to the Shir HaShirim, and then he uses that as a frame, and after each of the six knocks that the Rav describes that God granted us in the post-Holocaust era, right, the Rav concludes each one, the sort of the apex is, it is the voice of my beloved that knocks. Kol Dodi Dofek. And so that really becomes sort of the catchword and the leitmotif of this entire section. So what are these six knocks that the Rav identifies? Let's remember again, it's 1956. Right? This is right. Yeah, it's written, it was presented and then published in 1956, originally delivered at Yom HaTzma'ut at Yeshiva University. This is long before the Six-Day War, so he's clearly not going to be able to identify that. It's before the war in 1956, it's just before. So it's really just referring to those fledgling years, essentially from 1945 until 1948, and then coming to this time. What? 8 years ago, right? So, why is that? No, I think he means in midst of a night of terror. No, it's clearly, I mean, if you look, it's explicit in the book when it's published, since 1956. What is 8 years ago, we were still in the midst of the terror that enveloped us in the wake of the Holocaust. And the point is that in the midst of that, despite that being the casting that shadow, nonetheless we were able to found the State of Israel 8 years prior, 1948. So that's what the Rav means, that we are still enveloped by that Hester Panim Lichlat that he calls it. Right. He's talking about the founding of the State of Israel. So he suggests that essentially there were six knocks, and the question is, what were those knocks? So he says on the right side here, first, the knock of the beloved was heard in the political arena. No one can deny that from the standpoint of international relations, the establishment of the State of Israel in a political sense was an almost supernatural occurrence. Both Russian and Western countries jointly supported the idea of establishing a state, which we know, right, leading into the period of the Cold War, was a minor miracle or major miracle in its own right. This was perhaps the only proposal where East and West were united. This is a great line from the Rav. I'm inclined to believe, this is not particularly politically correct, he didn't really care, I'm inclined to believe the United Nations organization was created specifically for this purpose, in order to carry out the mission which divine providence has set for it. It seems to me that one cannot point to any other concrete achievements on the part of the UN. It's interesting, this line has been it's been bandied about a little bit. Some people try to use it to use the Rav in a political sense, in a, I guess, a more right-wing or conservative political context, and to try to point out that the Rav was being critical of the United Nations, and basically everything the UN is involved in is not necessarily for the benefit of Israel, isn't necessarily for the larger good. This is the one good that the Rav could identify. So the Rav is being very frank, and he's being honest. And this is back in 1956, but I believe he even repeated it subsequently over the course of the years. The Rav's political views are beyond the scope. It's a little more complicated, though. But it is an interesting comment. Now, then it becomes very moving. He says, our sages of blessed memory already expressed the view that at times rain descends for a single person or for a single blade of grass. I do not know whom the journalists, with their eyes of flesh and blood, saw sitting in the chairman's seat during that fateful session when the General Assembly decided in favor of the establishment of the state. However, someone who at that time observed matters well with his spiritual eye could have sensed the presence of the true chairman who presided over the discussion, i.e., the Beloved. It was he who knocked with his gavel on the podium. Do we not interpret the verse, that night the king of the kings slept, the sleep of the king fled, in the beginning of the sixth chapter of Megillat Esther, was referring to the sleep of the king of the universe, where Achashverosh alone, who could not sleep, would have been of no consequence. The salvation of Israel would not have blossomed forth on that night. However, it is the king of the universe who, as it were, does not slumber. Right? Then the redemption will be born. Right? And so on and so forth. So this is right, gorgeous, and then he concludes, right, it is the voice of my beloved that knocketh. Right? So the Rav, with this almost lyrical perspective, and he says, well, this is the modern day equivalent of the story of Esther. Right? Who's sitting on the throne? Achashverosh thinks, right, that he's the one who's sleepless. We all know, the reader understands that from our perspective, what's really happening is that it is the King of Kings who cannot sleep. The chairman can sit there with the gavel from today till tomorrow. We all know, those of us who have spiritual eyes know exactly who's banging that gavel. It's the chairman of chairmen. That's who it is. And so it's a beautiful idea. So the first knock that the Rav identifies is simply the political miracle of the birth of the state of Israel. The vote and so on and so forth. Okay. Number two, second, page 70, the knocking of the beloved could be heard on the battlefield. The small Israeli defense forces defeated the mighty armies of the Arab countries. It was the many in the hands of the few. It's Rabim Yad Me'atim. So it's, in certain respects, it's a reenactment of the holiday of Purim. In this respect, it's perhaps even closer to a reenactment of the holiday of Hanukkah. That's where that phrase comes from in Al-Hanisim for Hanukkah. Although in Purim, there's also the Jews being victorious on the battlefield, presumably as a minority, but that's particularly a Hanukkah-oriented kind of miracle. And then he suggests also that the lack of coordination among the Arab armies itself was foolish on their part and miraculous on the part of God. All they needed to do was to better coordinate and to have healthier, functional communication, and they could have much more easily attacked us. The fact that God did not allow for that, and that Paro hardened his heart as sort of the parallel to that, right? They refused. They hardened their hearts. They refused to work in proper collaboration, and that was part of what allowed us to be victorious during the very painful and drawn-out war of Milchemet Ha'atzma'ut, which, right, went from 1948 to 1949. It was November 1949. It's essentially a full 18 months. It's a very long battle. The third one is, to me, perhaps the most creative, and it's, to me, it's my favorite, just because if you would have asked me to list God's Knocks, I don't think I would have come up with the concept. That's the Rav's genius. But if there was someone gave me the framework and said, God knocked six times, right? And through, between 1948 and 1956, go list the knocks. So I think if we would have sat down and compiled our own list, we probably would have said the political, right, the UN voting, the establishment of the State of Israel. We would probably say the Jewish victory on the battlefield, that's a reasonable one. We'd probably say, as the Rav will say, just simple notion that Jews have a place to go, right? The notion that Jewish blood is not cheap, that we have self-defense, that we have Tzahal, we have our own standing army. For the first time in 2,000 years, we're autonomous. Those are some of the things that we would have said, and many of those the Rav lists and elaborates, albeit in a very moving way, but those I think are the ones that we might have expected. To me, the theological dimension that the Rav introduces in the third knock, I think is really creative, and I think really striking, and therefore, to me, is perhaps the most inventive of them all. So the Rav says, third, the beloved began to knock as well on the door of the theological tent. And it may very well be, and again, this is what's so striking, that this is the strongest knock of all. Ironically, the one that we might have been least likely to identify, the Rav suggests might be the most powerful of them all. I mean, if this is going beyond the establishment of the State of Israel, the notion that Jewish blood is not cheap anymore, that we have a place to return to, right, for Jewish refugees around the world and so on and so forth, and after all of that, this is the most substantial of them, there might be something really interesting here. And so the Rav essentially says, let's continue reading. I've often emphasized when speaking of the land of Israel, that all the claims of Christian theologians that God deprived the Jewish people of its rights in the land of Israel, and that all the biblical promises regarding Zion and Jerusalem refer, in an allegorical sense, to Christianity and the Christian church, have been publicly refuted by the establishment of the State of Israel and have been exposed as falsehoods lacking all validity. The Rav says that the establishment of Medina Israel is an outright rebuttal of thousands of years of, right, long over 1,000 years of Christian theology. The notion of supersessionism, the notion that Jews are in exile because we are no longer the chosen people, and that's why we don't have our own homeland, and that's why we are in exile, and that's why we're not autonomous. All of a sudden, we have a reversal. So Christian theology was rooted in a historical reality that has been turned on its head. That's a remarkable refutation of, right, again, of long over 1,000 years of Christian theology. The Rav then says, this is great, because you see the breadth of the Rav's readings, and this is a first-rate Talmudic scholar. This is a first-rate philosopher. But if I told you that the Rav was holding in Christian theology, and that he knew the New Testament inside and out, and he studied the apostles, and then he read, as we'll see, Christian newspapers, contemporary Christian newspapers as well, you might say, really? Like, when did he have time for all of that, right? But this is a man who was intensely curious and truly brilliant. And I'm not one to just throw around terms, but right, it's just a brilliant family, and he was no exception. So the Rav writes, it requires a comprehensive knowledge of Christian theological literature, from Justin the Martyr down to contemporary theologians, to properly appreciate the great miracle which so clearly invalidated the central premise of Christian theology. Right? Okay. And then he tells a story, right, about John Foster Dulles, who is known as a pretty anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic kind of reputation. He was the defense secretary, is that right?
State.
What? Or is it Secretary of State? It was Secretary of State, excuse me. And John Foster Dulles, so he had what the Rav basically identifies as a Freudian slip. What happened? So he says, we all take note of the learned explanation of our Secretary of State, oh, there it is, top of 71, Mr. John Foster Dulles, who also serves as an elder in the Episcopal Church, at a meeting of a Senate committee, that the Arabs hate the Jews because the Jews, get this, kill the founder of their religion.
Like Muhammad?
Okay, so now, right, this might be the first time since the advent of Islam, right, in roughly 621 of the Common Era, that the claim was made that the Jews murdered Muhammad. Right? This is not, I'm not an Islamic scholar, but I'm pretty sure that is not a staple of Muslim theology, right? From then all the way until. And yet that's exactly what John Foster Dulles said, albeit by accident, at this Senate committee meeting. So Rav says this quote-unquote explanation, what was it?
The Jews are responsible for the death of Jesus, so they must be responsible for the death of Muhammad, that's why.
Well, but that, I mean, you would hope that there, you know, you wouldn't make such a, you know, sort of a, right, a basic mistake. So the Rav says it's a Freudian slip of the tongue. This quote-unquote explanation possesses profound hidden symbolic significance. I'm not a psychologist and certainly not a psychoanalyst. However, I do have some acquaintance with the Talmud, and this is the Rav also, this is just, right? And I remember well what Rav Sheva said about Bilam, from his blessing you may learn what was in his heart. Bar Sanhedrin. When a person speaks at length, the truth may at times slip out. When one of the senators asked the Secretary of State, why do the Arabs hate the Jews? He really wanted to reply, I myself as a Christian don't bear any great love for them, for they killed our Messiah and as a result lost their share in the inheritance of Abraham. However, an angel intervened, or a bit was placed in the Secretary's mouth, as happened to Bilam, and said, uttering the words, our Messiah, and I myself, alternative terms slipped out of his mouth, and he said, the Arabs and Muhammad. And subconscious, he's afraid of the terrible fact that the Jewish people rule over Zion and Jerusalem. Okay, so this is, the Rav does not, I mean, he doesn't spare, right? He doesn't spare anyone here. He's very blunt. I find special pleasure in reading articles about the state of Israel in Catholic and Protestant newspapers. Okay? Like, when did the Rav have time to read Catholic and Protestant newspapers? I mean, this is unbelievable. What?
Hobby.
It's a hobby, right? The Rav is roughly 53 at this time. Okay? So like this, just on the side, when he had time, in between his classes. Right? This is when he was at the height, probably, of his intellectual capacities and achievement, but probably also the height of his responsibilities. I mean, he had his responsibilities back in Boston, which were pretty substantial. At YU, he was probably still teaching philosophy at this time, probably still at the Revel Graduate School, and he's giving his regular shiur. He has, you know, brilliant students that he, you know, the bright, very bright, capable students in their own right that he is teaching, you know, every single day for many hours. And yet, he finds time to read Catholic and Protestant newspapers, yeah.
Did he soften the stance that he originated in Russia towards the socialist Zionists?
Why do we think that he had a particularly harsh or negative stance toward the socialist Zionists?
He was atheistic. And,
right.
And there was a lot that he would object to. Still, they were Jews.
Right. He bluntly objected to them. He did disagree. He honestly says that that Chaim Herzog, a very famous Zionist, Nosson Chaim Weizmann, had a worldview that he just didn't agree with. But at the same time, he was, if not Cookian, you know, if he wasn't like Rav Kook, who embraced them and said that really they're profoundly religious and this is part of the messianic redemption and so on and so forth, and they have a key role to play in all of that. The Rav didn't go that far, certainly, but at the same time, he respected them and appreciated them, I think. So I don't think he was, I think he was honest that as a non-Torah worldview, it was incompatible with his worldview in traditional Judaism, yet I think he had real appreciation for the sacrifices that they made and for these accomplishments of his manifest here. So I think it's somewhere in between. Okay, and then the Rav says that he has he derives particular sense of satisfaction from reading in a newspaper that the response of the State of Israel is not as yet known, since today is the Sabbath and the officers of the ministries are closed, or from reading a news release that the United Press on Passover Eve that the Jews will sit down tonight at the Seder table confident that the miracles of Egypt will recur today. It is the voice of my beloved that knocks. This is, again, my favorite. Okay, number four is the tshuva movement, essentially. The Rav says that the travesties of the Holocaust did no favors to faith, to belief, to commitment to Judaism in any meaningful way. And he says the beloved is knocking in the hearts of the perplexed and assimilated youths. That the period of the Hester Panim in the 1940s, which resulted religiously in great confusion, says the Rav, and led people to flee from Judaism, now there's a sense that there's something that binds us together. And the Rav says, and I think it's true until this very day, that even Jews who don't necessarily have any other meaningful connection with the state of Israel, nonetheless, they have the connection, with Judaism, they have the connection through the state of Israel, and that pulls them in, and that creates an association. And we see that, whether it's the success of Birthright, right, and all these kinds of opportunities for, right, if you go on March of the Living, right, which the big one concluded, I think, just a few short weeks ago. Right, I think they conclude in Israel on Yom HaAtzmaut. Right, that's part of the itinerary, so it always happens around then. And so they always, right, so that's exactly what they do, right? And they're March of the Living. Many of the people who go are not necessarily religiously active or overly affiliated. And yet, that's essential to the itinerary. You go off, right? And then it's like kind of exile, and then you have redemption. It sort of mimics Jewish history, and then they come back to Israel, and you have... It's a religious experience. There's no question about it. So Israel provides that opportunity, even for those who have been fleeing from our tradition, and that's number four. Even those who, on the bottom of 72, this fact is of particular importance for Jews who are afflicted with self-hatred and wish to escape from Judaism and flee for their lives. They, like Jonah, seek to hide in the innermost part of the ship and wish to slumber, but the shipmaster does not allow them to ignore their fate. God says it's not possible to avoid what it means to be part of the Jewish people. That's knock number four. Then we come to number five. And this time the Rav, he's kind of hedging between three and five. Because here he says, the fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. So I don't know how... What did he say?
He said it's the strongest.
This is the strongest knock. And maybe... And what's the difference between strong knock and an important knock?
Sometimes the most important thing is... It doesn't have to be.
But what is...
He's saying the strongest, like a strong...
What is allowed? But I don't know what that...
I don't know if that's important, but... Because the fact that the Christians are... Because invalidating this, it has more resonance.
Maybe one is more important because it's basic, because it has to do with the survival of Jewish life. And that's five, and in that sense, it's perhaps the most important, but strongest in the sense that it's most miraculous. Right? The third one that you're referring to. Maybe that's what he has in mind. And this is the notion, and again, here the Rav pulls no punches. And this is a very open, honest presentation. Again, the Rav was originally presented this in a smaller audience, in Yeshiva University. It was to a particular segment of the community. It was, frankly, I think mostly to rabbis. That was the original presentation. He published it in Hebrew, and that was translated to English. So the original presentation was not meant for a wider audience, as opposed to, let's say, the Lonely Man of Faith, which was delivered in a Catholic seminary. So it's very interesting in that way. But whatever it is, the bottom line is that it's out here, it's open, and it's here for everyone to see. So the Rav writes, the fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. For the first time in the history of our exile, divine providence has surprised our enemies with the sensational discovery, eyes rolling, sarcastic all the way through, that Jewish blood is not free for the taking. It is not hefker. In other words, not ownerless. If anti-Semites wish to describe this phenomenon as an eye for an eye, check this, so be it, we will agree with them. Now this is really interesting, because we know that the rabbinic tradition classically reinterprets eye for an eye as metaphoric, right? You don't take out an eye for someone, right? It's not literal, it's a monetary compensation. And the Rav is, of course, the Talmudist and deeply committed to the validity of the oral law. And so the irony of the Rav saying, but you know what? Here, I'm okay with taking it literally, right? This is my exception. He says, if we wish to heroically defend our national historical existence, we must at times interpret the verse an eye for an eye literally. And the Rav is being very realistic. He's saying, look, self-defense means self-defense, period, end of story. We're not going to apologize for Tzaha. We're not going to apologize for the fact that 8 years after, right, the founding of the State of Israel, and just, right, less than 15 years after the Holocaust, that we're going to engage in self-defense. We have nothing to apologize for, period, end of story. And the Rav makes that point very directly. How many eyes did we lose during the course of a period of exile because we did not return blow for blow? This is the Rav being a traditional Zionist. I mean, he's clearly, obviously, not a secular Zionist, but this is Zionism. right? This is a more universal Zionistic streak. And the Rav says, it's pretty simple. If we don't have standing army, if we don't have self-defense, then they butcher us. And if we, right, if we come together and we train and we bear arms, so then we survive. It's really that simple. And that's one of the lessons of our history. The time has come for us to fulfill the law of an eye for an eye in its plain, simple sense. I'm certain that everyone who knows me knows that I'm a believer in the oral law, and consequently that I do not doubt that the verse refers to monetary compensation in according with the halakhic interpretation. However, with regard to Nasser or the Mufti, I would demand that we interpret the phrase an eye for an eye in a strictly literal sense as referring to the removal of the concrete actual eye. Pay no attention. Here's the... Right, I guess the reference to the secularists. Pay no attention to the fine phrases of the well-known Jewish assimilationists or socialists who continue to adhere to their at-war ideologies and think that they are living in the Bialystok, Minsk, or Brisk of 1905. Brisk, of course, is his own hometown. And who publicly declaim that it is forbidden for Jews, his family's hometown anyway, for Jews to take revenge at any time, any place, and under all circumstances. Vanity of vanities, revenge is forbidden when it serves no purpose. However, if by taking revenge we raise ourselves up to the plane of self-defense, that's all this is about, then it becomes the elementary right of man, qua man, to avenge the wrongs inflicted upon him. Right? And the idea of saving a life, and so on and so forth. Who was the Mufti, by the way? Right, what was he responsible for? He was the grand... He was not. Right, yeah. So he's not literally Nazi, but he was not a... He fomented... He was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and he fomented the 1929 riots in particular in Hebron. The yeshiva in Hebron and the community of Hebron at that time was massacred. It was previously a relatively safe community. It was essentially wiped out at that time. That's why the yeshiva of Hebron is ironically located in Yerushalayim. Right, it's a well-known yeshiva of Hebron in Yerushalayim. That's confusing. The reason is, it started in Hebron. In 1929, it moved. So the Rav says, look, there are many other people, I'll embrace them. But if you're going to declare war on us, so we declare the equal right to bear arms and to defend ourselves. And so the Rav, yeah.
This is a specific kind of question, but I'm just curious. Like, he's basically defending revenge, which is kind of radical in a certain way.
Depends what he means by revenge. But I don't know if he means...
It's in this specific context.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering if there's a difference, and maybe there's not an answer to this, between the act and the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what he... In other words, the act of revenge is more of, say, self-defense even, but the feeling that often one associates with revenge is much more of anger and hatred. And I wonder if there's a discernment there.
That's a great question.
I think he's defending having the right to defend yourself gives you some security and strength.
I understand, but would he say it's important to not feel the rage and anger, or is that okay?
Right.
I'm trying to see, like...
And that's not his concern here, so he doesn't...
Know,
and you're right,
saying,
that's what you're just asking.
It's not simply revenge, because of this behavior, you know what the future is.
But he uses the word.
Well, I will say, I don't know about in this context. His student, Rav Lichtenstein, certainly was one to cite the living in a very different time and different place, where Jewish security was much more assured than it was in 1956, and where the sense of militarism as sort of infecting the body politic of the Jewish people was a concern. And Rav Lichtenstein would quote the Ramban. The Ramban has a classic comment in which he says exactly this, that there's a difference between waging war and the legitimacy of waging war and not allowing it to turn us into animals.
Well, you know, and the terms here.
Right, it's a very different context. That's right. It's not, he's coming at it this from the opposite angle in context. These are reflections on the Holocaust. The reflections of the Holocaust are, look, you know, we've learned the hard way that we need to bear arms. You know, once we've been empowered for 50 years and we're more ensconced and we're established, then the conversation might change from the legitimacy of self-defense to the ethics of warfare. And what does it mean to have power and wield power in a way that we ensure survival, that is responsible to the perpetuation of the Jewish people, but also ensures that our soldiers do not become animals, right? And that, you know, we make ethical decisions, etc. And I think the Dov actually was very outspoken about those kinds of things later on. I'll talk more. In 1982, there was a big incident I can tell you about in Sabran Shatila, very famous massacre, Christian militants. Basically, it seems that as part of the Lebanon War, frankly, under Ariel Sharon's, he was the general. Under his command, the Christian militia...
Under his command,
when he was in command of the Israeli army, he was the general at the time, the Christian militia, which was not under the command of Tzahal, but was being watched over and sort of... So the Christian militiamen perpetrated a massacre of these Lebanese refugee camps in 1982. Of Muslims. It wasn't part of the war per se, and Israel had, by all accounts, Israel probably had the capacity to stop that massacre from taking place, and we did not. That was the issue, and the Rav at that time was extremely outspoken about the need for Israel to implement an independent commission that would conduct an inquiry, and even if it might quote unquote make us look bad among other nations because we're admitting responsibility, the Rav said, A, we actually will look good in the sense that we're being responsive, but we never look good either way, right? That's the point. And the Rav said, more to the point, it's our ethical responsibility. We can't allow for the murder of innocent people outside of the framework of war and not ask ourselves hard ethical questions. So the Rav is very mindful of that as well. I think it's a question of the context. It's a good question. Okay, 6 Nach on page 75. And the Rav says, this is the idea of kibbutz galuyot. This is the notion that Jews around the world, so as we fled from country to country, and as we were summarily expelled from all the Western European countries, right? All the different monarchies of Germany, and then France 3 times, and England, and then of course, most famously Spain in 1492, and then Portugal in 1497.
Internal inquiry about
the
Jews?
No, it's just great minds think alike. So So the Jews didn't necessarily know where in the world they were going. They literally wandered from country to country, hoping that it would be better here, hoping that it would be better there. This was the life of the Rambam. The Rambam, from a young age, he's 9 or 12 years old, roughly, when a radical Islamic sect, the Almohads, rise to power. His family flees. They flee to this place in Spain. They flee to that place in Spain. They flee to another place. They come to Morocco. They come to Fez. Then they eventually make their way over to Israel. And finally, about halfway through his life, he's in his 30s already, the Rambam's family settles in Egypt. But they're just wandering, and they don't have a destination. So not only are we exiled, and not only are we expelled from our homeland, but we're literally refugees. We don't know where we can go. And so finally, for the first time, the Rav says, Jews who don't necessarily have a place to go actually have a destination, which is, of course, Medina Israel. And that's really the 6th Nach. The 6th Nach, which we must not ignore, was heard when the gates of the land were open. A Jew who flees from a hostile country now knows that he can find a secure refuge in the land of his ancestors. This is a new phenomenon in our history, all right, and so on and so forth. Right? Who knows how many would have been saved from the Holocaust if there were this option? And there are many who have talked about the mood in Western Europe today in 2015, comparing it to the mood in the years preceding the rise of the Nazi Party. And there are many distinctions, but one of the distinctions in Western Europe proper, one of the distinctions is quite simply there's an alternative now. Frankly, there's a place. I'm not saying it's the only one, but. Right, clearly there's a place to go, whereas at that time there wasn't, and who knows how different things might have been if there was somewhere else that we had to go. So that's this point as well. Okay, just going to play with the side. Okay, so now the Rav says, okay, so these are the 6 knocks. It's the voice of my beloved that knocks. You can hear the soaring oratory. It's incredibly uplifting in that way. And now the Rav takes a very different turn and says, okay, God's knocking. How did we answer the door? Did we answer the door? And the Rav And it's, again, it's throughout an extremely honest and forthright piece. Essay, the Rav says, quite frankly, we've done something, but not nearly enough. And it's a very honest critique, he said, of the centrist or modern Orthodox Jewish community at that time. Not to say that he didn't have equal criticism of the non-observant Jewish community, not to say that he didn't have equal criticism of the parts of the Orthodox community to the right. Certainly the Rav felt that there was equal responsibility, but he also said our first responsibility is, and before we start pointing fingers elsewhere, is to look inward and to ask ourselves how we are doing. And essentially the Rav says, look, the existence of this fledgling state of Israel is not assured by any rational measure. Right? Not only in terms of its military security, but also financially. We know what the lira at the time was worth, right, relative to, let's say, the dollar. We know even 30 years ago what the shekel was worth relative to the dollar. It was like 20 to 1 or whatever it was. It's only more recent that Israel has a secure and stable economy. At that time, things were dire. Economically speaking, the American Jewish community was a relatively well-off one. It was fairly wealthy, had relatively deep pockets, and yet, the Rav said, quite frankly, have we given enough? Have we taken this seriously? God's knocking. Have we answered with the resources that we have to offer? Forget the money. What about considering Aliyah ourselves, the Rav says, quite frankly. And the Rav clearly didn't do that himself. But right, have we taken the responsibility to ask ourselves the hard questions, or are we just turning elsewhere and laying blame at the steps of others? And again, legitimately, in the sense that to the right, at that time, there wasn't a real meaningful support of the state of Israel, in a way that now that's changed to some degree. I mean, the notion of accepting Israel as a de facto reality and being more supportive, I'm not talking about Neturei Karta, or those, the people who stand on the side of the Israeli Day Parade and ruin the whole thing for all of us, if we let them. I don't mean them. I mean the mainstream Haredi community now in America is relatively supportive of the state of Israel as a fact on the ground. It's not that they would have supported its establishment in the first place, or at least the movement right toward it, but now that it exists, so there's a sort of a de facto support of the state of Israel. That's a real sea change. Certainly in 1956 that was far from the case. So the Rav says it's legitimate to point fingers and to critique other parts of the community in certain ways more harshly than our own. There's no question. And this is coming from someone who switched from the Aguda to Mizrahi after the Holocaust. The Rav was basically the next up-and-coming Gadol Hador. You know, we have the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah now, with all the great scholars in the Haredi community in Israel and in America, right? So Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky sits on it. The Rav, right? The Rav was the next up-and-coming. The Rav was being bred. He gave the hesped for Chaim Ozer Gwadzinski at an Aguda convention. Chaim Ozer was literally one of the Gedolei HaDor, the first great scholars of the generation. All of the great rabbis of that time come to the Aguda convention. The Rav is a 30-something, right? And he was the one who gave the hesped. And that's telling. He was the next in line. The Rav, who switched from the Aguda to Mizrahi, is, right, he says, quite honestly, we can be critical of the Aguda. Quite frankly, the Holocaust proved them wrong and proved the Zionists right. Period. End of story. That's what he says. He says that explicitly in one of his drashot. So the Rav has plenty of criticism for the right-wing movement at that time, but that's not the purpose of this essay. This is a speech delivered to the centrist Orthodox community associated with YU, where the Rav was operating and teaching at the time, and he says, we just haven't done what it is that we need to do.
He doesn't seem to be accountable to the fact that he saw it wrong.
That he
saw it all wrong. Like, in other words, he has this thing like, now that their miracle happened, we should go. But meanwhile, and there's a lot of connection, the Rav, and the, and the connection.
No, but what do you mean that he got it wrong?
That you know, that prior to the state, he was, you know, not a Zionist, and then the miracle of the state pushed him.
Well, I mean,
he doesn't go back. He doesn't speak because.
Well, he was born into that. I mean, the Rav was born into, his grandfather was one of the great anti-Zionists of the generation.
Real tethering of the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel, where, you know, for a long time that groundwork was being laid by others, you know, and that they could not have hit the ground running and had that state running up and fighting a war.
Well, the
had this plan to have this state been already rocking.
Right.
Zionism lived and breathed before the Holocaust.
And the Rav would say, No, that's a great point. I think the Rav would say that the Holocaust proves that the Zionist movement was correct all along.
Great.
Why wasn't the Rav an active Zionist before that? Because that was his upbringing. Because his grandfather was an anti-Zionist. Because his uncle...
I'm not questioning that. What I'm saying is that his rhetoric doesn't seem to... Mm-hmm. Like, his knocks don't start pre-Holocaust. His knocks start at that... in 1948.
Right.
And I feel like, wait, there was some knocking happening, you know?
No, but knocking not from God. Not miracles. I mean, these aren't miracles from God.
These are
kol dodi da fake. These are Shir HaShirim knocks. Right? So, I think you're right.
And
this is delivered on Yom Ha'atzma'ut.
Right.
So I think you're absolutely right. And if you read other drashot of the Rav, he writes explicitly that he claims basically that the argument between the Zionists and the anti-Zionists during the pre-World War II years was essentially one of reading the map. Who was prophesying correctly? What would be of this community? Right? So the anti-Zionists said, we're going to perpetuate, and we're going to do this, and whatever comes our way, this is the spiritual home. America is the Trefa Medina. There's certainly nothing to talk about in Israel. We don't want to push ahead God's hand in history. The Messiah is not here. We're not all Shomrei Torah Mitzvah. And then the Zionists disagree, and they said, this state prophesied doom. Right? Like Yirmiyahu is the prophet of doom. Yirmiyahu says, no, you don't understand. The temple is going to be destroyed. Submit to the Babylonians. That's the political message of Yirmiyahu. Right? The optimist, no, it's going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. Yirmiyahu says, I have a sobering message for you. And he turned out to be right. Right? So the same thing here. The Zionists had the sobering, honest message, and they were right. So the Rav knows how to talk about the fact that there were indications all along that should have moved us. I just don't think that's the focus of Kol Dodi da Fake.
I also think there's just a lot of we should be settling the South. We should be doing this. We're doing this.
Right. We should settle the Negev.
No,
he talks about.
There's no direct charge to his constituents, this Talmidim. You know, let's go. It wasn't to that point.
Right.
And,
this is a hard. Okay, you're raising a hard question.
And again, it's also very dangerous for us to live in this place where the Holocaust and Israel are tethered, because that's the best, you know, anti-Zionist argument is that,
Right, but in 19...
the legitimacy of Israel is like, you know...
But I think in 1950...
state only exists because...
But in 1956, I think, in that immediate context, I think it's very different than how we think about it 60 years later.
Yes and no, because 11 years later, they're gonna this Nakba thing is going to become, you know, it's going to retroactively, we're going to go back, and it's going to all... The Holocaust can't be part of the narrative. So, but okay, you're right. 1956, he doesn't know that.
I don't think it can't be.
He doesn't see that coming.
I think number one, it can't be the only part of the narrative, and certainly the Rav doesn't think it's the only part of the narrative. And number two, 8 years later,
it has to be part of the narrative.
It is what it is. We're in the ashes.
That's true.
You know, I think it's different.
No, that's true.
Half of the Jewish population was probably in Russia and oppressed and was likely to lose their Judaism in a very short period of time. Not as short as the Holocaust, but lose it just the same.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. All right, so now the Rav takes a turn. And the Rav says, okay, so, you know, have we missed the moment that he's been knocking for 8 years? Have we been responsive? Okay, now the Rav takes, again, a different turn. And he starts to discuss, very relevant for Shavuot, he says, there are two covenants. He says there's the covenant of fate and the covenant of destiny. And we've got 5 minutes, so I'm going to give the quick flyby. Basically, what the Rav says is that if you take a look at our forefathers and our forebears, there was a covenant with Abraham, and there's a covenant at Sinai. So Rav says, why do we need two covenants? What's the nature of each? And the Rav basically distinguishes between fate and destiny. And this is an English translation of Kol Dedida Fake, instead of the title being published as "It is the voice of my beloved that knocks," the English title is actually Fate and Destiny, on the basis of this dichotomy. And the Rav says, what is the difference between fate and destiny? Fate is what we are inextricably bound to as a people. Destiny is what we aspire toward. Fate is what must be. Destiny is what can be. So the covenant with Abraham is that the Jews will go into exile, will suffer in a land that is not their own for 400 years, and afterward they will emerge redeemed. But along the way there's going to be suffering. That prefigures, says the Rav, all other suffering and shared fate, shared Jewish experience that we undergo over the course of our history. So when the Jews suffer together as a community in the Holocaust, when anything goes wrong, there's a sense of shared fate. Right? Destiny, though, that's, we're talking about Shavuot, that's the covenant at Sinai, that's what we ought to do. That's not what we might call, the Rav does not use this term, but I'll use it, a horizontal covenant. In other words, not that binds us together with our fellow Jews, but rather it's vertical. It's what binds each of us and us as a people up to God. And that's really the focus of the covenant of fate. And the Rav unpacks each of these, and he says a fate-laden Jew has a different kind of existence, talking about the first covenant, than someone who's not, doesn't have a sense of shared experience with the rest of the Jewish people. He says, right, you know, someone who, when their friend is suffering, when Jews are, right, Jews in Russia or wherever they are throughout the world, something's going wrong over there. I'm struggling. I feel traumatized. Right, this is something that eats me up. The Rav says there's the classic parable of, if you want to know if the Siamese twins are one person or two, so what do? Right, you pour scalding water on one, and if the other one yells out in pain, so then you know that they're one person. If it doesn't, then they're two. So it says that's the test. Right? If we pour scalding water over there, do we yelp out in pain? Or do we say, you know what, probably it's, you know, that's my brethren, and the Torah says that I should really be concerned for the plight of my brethren, so you know what, let me donate to tzedakah. The Rav says, no, this is gut, this is instinct, this is in our kishkas. We're suffering because one of our limbs is in pain. The Rav says, that's the covenant of faith. The Rav says, quite frankly, the reason we have not responded properly to the Holocaust and to the the knocks of the last 8 years is because we have a shortcoming in regard to our sense of shared fate. It somehow was lacking. The Rav says during the time of the Holocaust it was lacking. That's his stress. If you jump for a second, the Rav says, what?
That's the Job critique too. It's the same.
The Job critique. Yeah, it's very much connected. Right. That's exactly right. The Rav says this is manifest in four ways. He says it finds lots of manifestation. And then, one second. Forget where it is. But at some point, he says quite explicitly, here it is. If you jump to page 96, sorry, it's not, again, not on the top, but it's got on the bottom left, melancholy reflections and confessions. After he goes through each one, and he explains the covenant of fate and the covenant of destiny, and he gives other analogs to each of them, he says, let us ask a simple question. Have we not sinned against the covenant of fate, the covenant made with the camp people? Right? And then he says a couple lines down, bottom of 96, let us be frank. What? Yeah, he talked about it, I just didn't have time. He distinguishes between two types of Jewish connection. One is a machaneh, the other is edah. Machaneh is an encampment for warfare. That's to protect the Jewish people who go out to war. That's the destiny. It's an encampment that reflects the destiny of fate. And then edah is what is getting a minyan together. And so that's representative of a different kind of coming together as a community. That's the covenant of destiny. So that's the distinction between the two. So that's what he's referring to here. The camp people, the machaneh, is the fate one. Says the Rav, well, let us be frank, during the terrible Holocaust, when European Jewry was being systematically exterminated in the ovens and crematoria, the American Jewish community did not rise to the challenge. Right? And he's very blunt. You can read it. We didn't go to Roosevelt. We didn't issue a sharp protest warning. And the Rav says, I include everyone. When I say we, I mean all of us, myself included, rabbis and laymen, Orthodox and free thinkers, the entire spectrum of Jewish political organizations, the whole nine yards. Why? And then he explicitly invokes Eov, right? So for any of that's for you, right? It's because we didn't have that chesed awareness, because we didn't feel that we have a powerful enough sense of what it meant to be part of the covenant of fate with our people.
The sense of peoplehood was flawed.
The sense of peoplehood was flawed. And by the way, I would say that if the Rav's generation was lacking, I will say bluntly that I think my generation is lacking. I think my children's generation is lacking. I think young people now, I mean, it's such a time of rampant individualism, and we haven't lived through the miracles of, right? My generation and my children, again, we don't know what it was like to be without a state of Israel, to be without the miracles of a state of Israel. I mean, we don't know what this state war was like.
So what's the cure to this?
To be honest, though, there were 400 rabbis that did try to speak to Roosevelt.
I know, but I understand. Right. We have to go to Mariv, so I can't answer that one. The Rav doesn't say. I will say this. I know a well-known rabbi who lives in Teaneck, traveled to Paris for the first time. I think it was for the first time. He is well-read. He knows everything that's happening there. He said nothing that he read in a newspaper, on social media, whatever, nothing, Charlie Hebdo, the whole nine yards, nothing could prepare him for what it was like to be there and to walk around in Paris. And to go to shuls in Paris, and to go to schools in Paris, and to feel what it was like, to feel the anxiety, and this is Paris, there are places where it's worse, to feel that anxiety firsthand of what it meant to feel so insecure as a Jew living.
Oh, it's Charlie Hebdo.
Now, he went, a month ago. He went a month ago. He's there.
What are they saying?
What?
What are they saying?
Oh, separate question. Important question, but yes. Separate question. I don't know the answer. The only answer I can share is I think if we're not there with Jews, if we don't, then we come back, we carry those experiences with us.
Terror is like, you're not feeling
it. If you live in Israel when rockets are falling, and that's why Western countries have such a block, it's not only because they're like Stam anti-Semitic or this or that. There are very deep rooted biases and there is deep rooted anti-Semitism, but part of it is that frankly if it's not your own children and it's not in your backyard, you can't formulate a policy because, right, or you have to formulate a policy, but you can't get on the other side of the experience. All of a sudden when it's the Mexico border and people are, you know, are firing rockets every single day on, you know, on Dallas, Texas, you know, or whatever, like, you know, it's different, right? It's like, oh, Like, this is a different situation. So that's my immediate answer, but yeah. So anyhow, all right. There's more here, but the last time. Next week we're having a special Eskara for Rav Lichtenstein. That's going to be Wednesday night. So we're not going to have the regular class. I know there have been a couple of interruptions recently. I apologize for those, but at the same time, I do think it's a very important thing. We're having an Azkara for Rav Lichtenstein, for Aaron Lichtenstein from Gush, who passed away recently. And we have a number of students of his in the community. So we're going to be sharing some reflections, and all are welcome to be there. Sharing from his Torah as well. So, what?
Son-in-law.
Absolutely. The son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, as Alicia points out. The Rav's son-in-law. So just to bring that in context. Thank